Chapter 3. How to get at the meat of these matters. Indeed, I would, Captain, if you don't mind. Then the captain proceeded as follows, I'll do it with pleasure. First, you see, I read, and thought, till I got to understand what sort of people they were in the old Bible times, and then after, that it was all clear and easy. Now this was the way I put it up. Concerning Isaac, this is the captain's own mistake, and the prophets of Baal. There was some mighty sharp men among the public characters of that old ancient day, and Isaac was one of them. Isaac had his failings, plenty of them too. It ain't for me to apologize for Isaac. He played it on the prophets of Baal, and like enough he was justifiable, considering the odds that was against him. No, all I say is, 'twan't any miracle, and that I'll show you so you can see it yourself. Well, times had been getting rougher and rougher for prophets, that is, prophets of Isaac's denomination. There was 450 prophets of Baal in the community, and only one Presbyterian. That is, if Isaac was a Presbyterian, which I reckon he was, but it don't say. Naturally, the prophets of Baal took all the trade. Isaac was pretty low-spirited, I reckon, but he was a good deal of a man, and no doubt he went a-prophesying around, letting on to be doing a land office business, but 'twan't any use. He couldn't run any opposition to amount to anything. By and by things got desperate with him. He sets his head to work and thinks it all out, and then what does he do? Why, he begins to throw out hints that the other parties are this and that, and toter dash nothing very definite, maybe, but just kind of undermining their reputation in a quiet way. This made talk, of course, and finally got to the king. The king asked Isaac what he meant by his talk. Says Isaac, "Oh, nothing particular. Only, can they pray down fire from heaven on an altar? It ain't much, maybe, your majesty, only can they do it? That's the idea." ... So the king was a good deal disturbed, and he went to the prophets of Baal, and they said, pretty airy, that if he had an altar ready, they were ready, and they intimated he better get it insured too. So next morning all the children of Israel, and their parents and the other people gathered themselves together. Well, here was that great crowd of prophets of Baal packed together on one side, and Isaac walking up and down all alone on the other, putting up his job. When time was called, Isaac led on to be comfortable and indifferent, told the other team to take the first innings. So they went at it, the whole 450, praying around the altar, very hopeful, and doing their level best. They prayed an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and so on, plumb till noon. It wasn't any use. They hadn't took a trick. Of course they felt kind of ashamed before all those people, and well they might. Now, what would a magnanimous man do? Keep still, wouldn't he? Of course. What did Isaac do? He graveled the prophets of Baal every way he could think of. Says he, "You don't speak up loud enough. Your God's asleep, like enough, or maybe he's taking a walk. You want to holler, you know," or words to that effect. I don't recollect the exact language. Mind, I don't apologize for Isaac. He had his faults. Well, the prophets of Baal prayed along the best they knew how all the afternoon, and never raised a spark. At last, about sundown, they were all tuckered out, and they owned up and quit. What does Isaac do now? He steps up, and says to some friends of his there, "Pour 4 barrels of water on the altar." ... Everybody was astonished, for the other side had prayed at it dry, you know, and got whitewashed. They poured it on. Says he, "Heave on 4 more barrels. ... Then he says, "Heave on 4 more. ... 12 barrels, you see, altogether. The water ran all over the altar, and all down the sides, and filled up a trench around it that would hold a couple of hogsheads measures. ... It says, I reckon it means about a hogshead. Some of the people were going to put on their things and go, for they allowed he was crazy. They didn't know Isaac. Isaac knelt down and began to pray. He strung along and strung along about the heathen in distant lands, and about the sister churches, and about the state and the country at large, and about those that's in authority in the government, and all the usual program, you know, till everybody had got tired and gone to thinking about something else. And then, all of a sudden, when nobody was noticing, he outs with a match, and rakes it on the underside of his leg, and PFF, up the whole thing blazes like a house afire. 12 barrels of water? Petroleum, sir, petroleum. That's what it was.
Petroleum, Captain?
Yes, sir, the country was full of it. Isaac knew all about that. He read the Bible. Don't you worry about the tough places. They ain't tough when you come to think them out and throw light on them. There ain't a thing in the Bible but what is true. All you want is to go prayerfully to work and cipher out how it was done. At 8 o'clock on the third morning out from New York, a land was sighted. Away across the sunny waves one saw a faint dark stripe stretched along under the horizon, or pretended to see it, for the credit of his eyesight. Even the Reverend said he saw it, a thing which was manifestly not so. But I never have seen anyone who was morally strong enough to confess that he could not see land when others claimed that they could. By and by the Bermuda Islands were easily visible. The principal one lay upon the water in the distance, a long, dull-colored body, scalloped with slight hills and valleys. We could not go straight at it, but had to travel all the way around it, 16 miles from shore, because it is fenced with an invisible coral reef. At last we sighted buoys, bobbing here and there, and then we glided into a narrow channel among them, raised the reef, and came upon shoaling blue water that soon further shoaled into pale green, with a surface scarcely rippled. Now came the resurrection hour. The berths gave up their dead. Who are these pale specters in plug hats and silken flounces that file up the companionway in melancholy procession and step upon the deck? These are they which took the infallible preventive of seasickness in New York Harbor, and then disappeared and were forgotten. Also there came two or three faces not seen before until this moment. One's impulse is to ask, "Where did you come aboard?" We followed the narrow channel a long time, with land on both sides, low hills, that might have been green and grassy, but had a faded look instead. However, the landlocked water was lovely, at any rate, with its glittering belts of blue and green where moderate soundings were, and its broad splotches of rich brown, where the rocks lay near the surface. Everybody was feeling so well, that even the grave, pale young man, who, by a sort of kindly common consent, had come latterly to be referred to as P.S., received frequent and friendly notice, which was right enough, for there was no harm in him. At last we steamed between two island points whose rocky jaws allowed only just enough room for the vessel's body, and now before us loomed Hamilton on her clustered hillsides and summits, the whitest mass of terraced architecture that exists in the world, perhaps. It was Sunday afternoon, and on the pier were gathered 100 or 200 Bermudians, half of them black, half of them white, and all of them nobly dressed, as the poet says. Several boats came off to the ship, bringing citizens. One of these citizens was a faded, diminutive old gentleman, who approached our most ancient passenger with a childlike joy in his twinkling eyes, halted before him, folded his arms, and said, smiling with all his might, and with all the simple delight that was in him, "You don't know me, John. Come, out with it now, you know you don't." The ancient passenger scanned him perplexedly, scanned the napless, threadbare costume of venerable fashion that had done Sunday service no man knows how many years, contemplated the marvelous stovepipe hat of still more ancient and venerable pattern, with its poor, pathetic old stiff brim canted up callously in the wrong places, and said, with a hesitation that indicated strong internal effort to lace the gentle old apparition, "Why? Let me see. Plague on it. There's something about you that..."
... But I've been gone from Bermuda for 27 years, and... I don't seem to get at it, somehow, but there's something about you that is just as familiar to me as likely it might be his hat, murmured the ass, with innocent, sympathetic interest. So the Reverend and I had at last arrived at Hamilton, the principal town in the Bermuda Islands. A wonderfully white town, white as snow itself, white as marble, white as flour. Yet looking like none of these, exactly. Never mind, we said. We shall hit upon a figure by and by that will describe this peculiar white. It was a town that was compacted together upon the sides and tops of a cluster of small hills. Its outlying borders fringed off and thinned away among the cedar forests, and there was no woody distance of curving coast or leafy islet sleeping upon the dimpled, painted sea, but was flecked with shining white points, half-concealed houses peeping out of the foliage. The architecture of the town was mainly Spanish, inherited from the colonists of 250 years ago. Some ragged dash-topped cocoa palms, glimpsed here and there, gave the land a tropical aspect. There was an ample pier of heavy masonry. Upon this, under shelter, were some thousands of barrels containing that product which has carried the fame of Bermuda to many lands, the potato, with here and there an onion. That last sentence is facetious, for they grow at least two onions in Bermuda to one potato. The onion is the pride and joy of Bermuda. It is her jewel, her gem of gems. In her conversation, her pulpit, her literature, it is her most frequent and eloquent figure. In Bermuda metaphor it stands for perfection, perfection absolute. The Bermudian weeping over the departed exhausts praise when he says, he was an onion. The Bermudian extolling the living hero bankrupts applause when he says, he is an onion. The Bermudian setting his son upon the stage of life to dare and do for himself climaxes all counsel, supplication, admonition, comprehends all ambition, when he says, be an onion. When parallel with the pier, and 10 or 15 steps outside it, we anchored. It was Sunday, bright and sunny. The groups upon the pier dash men, youths, and boys were whites and blacks in about equal proportion. All were well and neatly dressed, many of them nattily, a few of them very stylishly. One would have to travel far before he would find another town of 12,000 inhabitants that could represent itself so respectably, in the matter of clothes, on a freight pier, without premeditation or effort. The women and young girls, black and white, who occasionally passed by, were nicely clad, and many were elegantly and fashionably so. The men did not affect summer clothing much, but the girls and women did, and their white garments were good to look at, after so many months of familiarity with summer colors. Around one isolated potato barrel stood four young gentlemen, two black, two white, becomingly dressed, each with the head of a slender cane pressed against his teeth, and each with a foot propped upon the barrel. Another young gentleman came up, looked longingly at the barrel, but saw no rest for his foot there, and turned pensively away to seek another barrel. He wandered here and there, but without result. Nobody sat upon the barrel, as is the custom of the idle in other lands, yet all the isolated barrels were humanly occupied. Whosoever had a foot to spare put it on a barrel, if all the places on it were not already taken. The habits of all peoples are determined by their circumstances. The Bermudians lean upon barrels because of the scarcity of lamp posts. Many citizens came on board and spoke eagerly to the officers inquiring about the Turco-Russian war news, I supposed. However, by listening judiciously I found that this was not so. They said, what is the price of onions? Or, how's onions? Naturally enough this was their first interest, but they dropped into the war the moment it was satisfied. We went ashore, and found a novelty of a pleasant nature. There were no hackmen, hacks, or omnibuses on the pier, or about it anywhere, and nobody offered his services to us, or molested us in any way. I said it was like being in heaven. The Reverend rebukingly and rather pointedly advised me to make the most of it then. We knew of a boarding house, and what we needed now was somebody to pilot us to it. Presently a little barefooted colored boy came along, whose raggedness was conspicuously not Bermudian. His rear was so marvelously bepitched with colored squares and triangles that one was half persuaded he had got it out of an atlas. When the sun struck him right, he was as good to follow as a lightning bug. We hired him, and dropped into his wake. He piloted us through one picturesque street after another, and in due course deposited us where we belonged. He charged nothing for his map, and but a trifle for his services. So the Reverend doubled it. The little chap received the money with a beaming applause in his eye which plainly said, "This man's an onion." We had brought no letters of introduction. Our names had been misspelled in the passenger list. Nobody knew whether we were honest folk or otherwise. So we were expecting to have a good private time in case there was nothing in our general aspect to close boarding house doors against us. We had no trouble. Bermuda has had but little experience of rascals, and is not suspicious. We got large, cool, well-lighted rooms on a second floor, overlooking a bloomy display of flowers and flowering shrubs, scalia and annunciation lilies, lantanas, heliotrope, jasmine, roses, pinks, double geraniums, hollanders, pomegranates, blue morning dash glories of a great size, and many plants that were unknown to me. We took a long afternoon walk, and soon found out that that exceedingly white town was built of blocks of white coral. Bermuda is a coral island, with a 6-inch crust of soil on top of it, and every man has a quarry on his own premises. Everywhere you go you see square recesses cut into the hillsides, with perpendicular walls unmarred by crack or crevice, and perhaps you fancy that a house grew out of the ground there, and has been removed in a single piece from the mold. If you do, you err. But the material for a house has been quarried there. They cut right down through the coral, to any depth that is convenient, 10 to 20 feet, and take it out in great square blocks. This cutting is done with a chisel that has a handle 12 or 15 feet long, and is used as one uses a crowbar when he is drilling a hole, or a dasher when he is churning. Thus soft is this stone. Then with a common handsaw they saw the great blocks into handsome huge bricks that are 2 feet long, a foot wide, and about 6 inches thick. These stand loosely piled during a month to harden, then the work of building begins. The house is built of these blocks. It is roofed with broad coral slabs an inch thick, whose edges lap upon each other, so that the roof looks like a succession of shallow steps or terraces. The chimneys are built of the coral blocks, and sawed into graceful and picturesque patterns. The ground floor veranda is paved with coral blocks, also the walk to the gate. The fence is built of coral blocks built in massive panels, with broad capstones and heavy gate posts, and the whole trimmed into easy lines, and comely shape with the saw. Then they put a hard coat of whitewash, as thick as your thumbnail, on the fence and all over the house, roof, chimneys, and all. The sun comes out and shines on this spectacle, and it is time for you to shut your unaccustomed eyes, lest they be put out. It is the whitest white you can conceive of, and the blindingest. A Bermuda house does not look like marble, it is a much intenser white than that, and, besides, there is a dainty, indefinable something else about its look that is not marble-like. We put in a great deal of solid talk and reflection over this matter of trying to find a figure that would describe the unique white of a Bermuda house, and we contrived to hit upon it at last. It is exactly the white of the icing of a cake, and has the same unemphasized and scarcely perceptible polish. The white of marble is modest and retiring compared with it. After the house is cased in its hard scale of whitewash, not a crack, or sign of a seam, or joining of the blocks is detectable, from base stone to chimney top. The building looks as if it had been carved from a single block of stone, and the doors and windows sawed out afterward. A white marble house has a cold, tomb-like unsociable look, and takes the conversation out of a body and depresses him. Not so with a Bermuda house. There is something exhilarating, even hilarious, about its vivid whiteness, when the sun plays upon it. If it be of picturesque shape and graceful contour and many of the Bermudian dwellings are, it will so fascinate you, that you will keep your eyes on it until they ache. One of those clean-cut, fanciful chimneys too pure and white for this world, with one side glowing in the sun, and the other touched with a soft shadow, is an object that will charm one's gaze by the hour. I know of no other country that has chimneys worthy to be gazed at and gloated over. One of those snowy houses, half concealed and half glimpsed through green foliage, is a pretty thing to see, and if it takes one by surprise and suddenly, as he turns a sharp corner of a country road, it will ring an exclamation from him, sure. Wherever you go, in town or country, you find those snowy houses, and always with masses of bright-colored flowers about them, but with no vines climbing their walls. Vines cannot take hold of the smooth, hard whitewash. Wherever you go, in the town, or along the country roads. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.